It's probably just as well. I don't think I'll say I made a very good communist. I want to preface what I'm about to say by a reference to yesterday morning's discussion, because I'm going to be speaking about contemporary American conservatism and our immediate future. But in view of the fact there was so much discussion of definition, I think it might not be a bad idea to add to what I had in mind to say a very simple and, as far as I'm concerned, satisfactory definition of conservatism as I see it today. And I would regard the conservatism I'm talking about as a movement of thought and action designed to recover and to interpret and carry out in modern conditions the tradition of Western civilization and of the United States. And when I say tradition, I know tradition is mixed. I know that there's no such thing as deliberately following it. The phrase I like to use is our reason operating within tradition. Because tradition is, the great advantage of tradition is that it keeps you from jumping off on your own, either as a human being or as a single generation or as a group. All tradition is in the end is the consolidated or coagulated reason, wisdom, and experience of previous generations. And believe me, it's mixed, as we saw a few moments ago. But there are choices to be made. But above all, I feel that the dangers that we as conservatives are fighting against must be those of taking a rigid and ideological attitude toward the tradition. As an example, in the recent few minutes, I would say that one of the things the conservative tradition stands for is to be very wary of destroying any social evil, however evil it may be, at a cost of disrupting and distorting the political structure that makes the solution of social evils and the preservation of freedom possible. One need not defend slavery in 1860 or starvation in 1970, if such a thing exists, in order to say there are things the federal government cannot and should not do. There are rights of the states that need to be preserved. There are the freedom of the legislative and the judiciary and the executive from each other. And it is more important to preserve those than to right any wrong. Because given the structure of freedom, the wrongs will eventually be righted. Given the destruction of that structure, the process we've been going through with accelerating speed from Andrew Jackson to Abraham Lincoln to Woodrow Wilson to Franklin Roosevelt, given that, we may not be able to solve any of these problems. The contemporary American conservative movement, about which I'm talking specifically, came into existence 15 to 20 years ago only. It is a young movement. Like all conscious conservative movements, it was a response to revolution. It was moved to reassert values overturned, as all conservative movements have been. In this case, it was a response to the Roosevelt Revolution of the early 1930s, the coming to power of liberalism in this country. Liberalism, by the way, which is no relation whatever to 19th century liberalism, with its concern for freedom and for the limitation of state power. Liberalism, and we have to use the word because it's the going word, is simply the polite American term for democratic socialism. Indeed, the Roosevelt Revolution did not stand by itself, though less complete, gentler, bloodless, in every way preferable, it still was part of the worldwide revolution of the 20th century. The same essential direction of movement as at its most extreme were exemplified by Lenin and by Hitler, by the Russian and German revolutions, at another level by the so-called National Socialism of Nasser, Nkrumah, Sukarno, by the English and Scandinavian social democracy at a lesser level of horror. And I would say the Roosevelt Revolution stands roughly on the same level with those last, the English and Scandinavian, but all part of one single movement of thought, varying in many ways, but movement of action toward collectivism. After the Roosevelt victory, liberalism swept from strength to strength. For many years, opposition to it did not exist in the form of a concerted movement. It was scattered and divided. A hard-bitten minority in Congress holding the fort as best they could. Some economists and some humanists in the universities. a continuing endemic anti-communism among the people, but no unified movement knitting together all these strands of domestic and foreign relations opposition to liberalism. No conservative movement, essentially until the late 40s or early 50s. Think of how brief a time National Review, Modern Age, a general conservative literature, YAF, ISI, the Philadelphia Society itself, the American Conservative Union came into existence. These were the milestones of the development of a conscious conservative movement. Extended itself into the political scene and in 1964 captured the Republican Party, not 15 years after its birth. These were the origins of the contemporary American conservatism. It was born in the struggle against liberalism. And in a real sense, I would say it faces something of a crisis of direction today, with the beginning of what I think can legitimately be called a post-liberal age. What do I mean by that? Largely as a result of 20 years of conservative critique and attack, partly as a result of an attack from a totally different side by the radicals liberalism has spawned as its children, I would say that it is undeniable that as of today, liberalism has lost its charisma, lost its intellectual defenses, lost its power of intellectual conviction. But I do not mean that it's lost its power. Liberals are in the seats of power wherever one looks still. But liberalism, as a mode of conviction, of convincing, really doesn't exist. And most of the liberals who hold power hold it on a purely pragmatic and power-holding basis, shored up by the remaining prejudices and aphorisms of a once lively movement. In the media, in the academy, in a large part of the political arena, throughout the establishment, they stand, but they stand as rotten hulks of a live, living political position. They hold by the inertia of power itself, not by any dynamism of their creed. If you wish to see the contrast purely symbolically, just think of the power and vigor of a Franklin Roosevelt and the power and vigor of a Hubert Horatio Humphrey. Compare, look upon this picture and upon this. These are symbolic and true of the differences between the early 30s and today. The dynamism of the attack on civilization now has passed from the liberals in America to the nihilists created by liberalism's subversion of value. I say created by it because liberals were their teachers, their parents. They created the atmosphere in which a new generation has grown up with nothing in the existing established set of power that they can believe in, moving in a nihilist direction in their thinking, in various ways. This, what Gerhard Niemeyer has called the total critique of society. It takes a number of forms. In some minority degree, it is Marxist, but it's very likely that that minority of the radical movement will, as the others lose their force through their disorganization, take control of it. But it is partly Marxist, partly anarchist, and partly what we call the counterculture. Differ though the Marxist elements, the anarchist elements, and the goof-off counterculture elements may be from each other, they are all the product of liberalism and of the world that liberalism let them inherit. All are devoted in one way or another to a Gnostic attack on the whole of tradition and the whole of the structure of society that has been created, frankly, going, in the case of the anarchist and the counterculture elements, further even than an attack on civilization, on the civilization which they are presented with, but an attack on the very concepts of civilization, a return to polymorphous sexuality of the amoeba, a return to living without the responsibilities of work and effort, of living without organization, of living without reading, of living without thought, and living without background. This is a critique not merely of our civilization, but of all civilization as it has been known. All that men have laboriously created to build a free and an ordered society. As a result, conservatism now has a double task, and here is the first problem of our conservatism of the coming years. simultaneously to wrest political and intellectual power from the epigonoi of liberalism, who still hold the seats of power, so as to have for ourselves the power to reestablish the order on which true civil freedom depends. And simultaneously, as I said, to carry out the intellectual and the practical attack on the radical nihilist and the counterculture. Here, too, dangers exist. Dangers I have observed as we have moved along in the past 4 or 5 years in which this double enemy has become the issue of the day. First, this, by the way, are dangers which have most had to be tackled with most directly so far by conservatives in the universities, where the issue has been abrupt and immediate to them. Two problems. But one which, while it has so far mainly been a problem for university active conservatives, I think is going to become so for all of us. On the one hand, since the attack of the radicals is first upon liberal structures, the universities as they have developed, for example, the corporate liberalism, which is one of their favorite words, the temptation of conservatives to stand above the fray, stand by and say, well, go it, radicals, go it, anarchists, tear them down. The liberals are only getting what they deserve. A sort of schadenfreude in which we cannot and should not indulge. For that structure, shot through though it is with liberal power, created in its present forms to a degree by liberalism, is the structure of civilization itself, to the preservation of which we have to be devoted. On the other hand, there is another danger to fear, and justly. Justly, the fear that the anarchy is so dangerous, that it is so tearing down the structure, that we should uncritically support liberal institutions and structures because they at least do represent some civilized order. This danger is as great as the other. Not only because the liberal institutions, orders, and structures are wrong and are steadily leading society in the wrong direction, but because in actual fact, as they presently stand, they could not and cannot stand against the attack from the far left. They don't have the guts or the structure. Both of these are extreme proposals. Neither of them need be followed. It is perfectly possible, and it seems to me it is the mission of conservatives today, to work together with those same liberals who are trying to hold back the forces of destruction in a practical matter, but without giving up the intellectual critique of the spiritual wasteland that liberalism has created, that which is itself the primary cause of the emergence of the new nihilism. There is nothing whatever to keep us from the practical day-to-day defense of order, even though it is still to a considerable degree an order shot through with liberalism, against the attacks of radicalism, violence, anarchism, the counterculture, and at the same time to continue the critique that we have for 20 years been engaged in against the assumptions of that situation, and to try to move to change it and to ourselves take over the power to control that society, that structure, and to transform it. That's the first problem I see facing conservatism in a post-liberal era. Secondly, another problem arises from the decay of a clear-cut liberalism as a target, together with the simultaneous emergence not only of radicalism and of the counterculture's attacks on civilizational order, but also of the prevalence of individual criminal violence, also a result of the long-term effect of liberalism. The problem of actual decay of the minima of civilizational order, the instinctive demand which goes deep in the American people and the great producing majority for something to be done about it. Again, there seem to me to be two temptations that have to be avoided, and both of them have appeared. And I think this is perhaps the central problem to the just solution of which, by avoiding both extremes, Conservatism must direct its attention if it is going to do what is in its power to do in the years in front of us. Both of these temptations, some of us have already found ourselves actively combating in the recent period. Take the first one. The first one is so to be appalled by the breakdown of order as to desert the American conservative movement's reasoned and instinctive understanding of the necessity of an order based upon rational freedom, a constitutional order of a division of powers. The temptation to do so existed, as we have heard earlier, at the time of the Civil War, and it was yielded to. The temptation to do so existed for certain people in terms of social inequalities, and it has been yielded to. These first by a radical Abraham Lincoln, then by a liberal Franklin Roosevelt. In both cases, because of the temptation of overcoming a problem, the structure of conceived by the founding fathers was deeply weakened. There's now a tendency among conservatives to do the same thing for conservative reasons. To say order above all, and there can be nothing without order, correct. But there are orders and orders, and the question is how to preserve a free order, not how to preserve order as such. So that one of the temptations is to be so appalled by the breakdown of order as to desert, as Lincoln and Roosevelt did on the other side before us, desert the very structure that we have wanted to preserve order in order to preserve, and to follow the specious appeal of an extra-constitutional authoritarianism, the thought of a man on horseback that'll drive these people out of the streets and make it safe for your wife to walk down the road, never mind what the cost. This is doubly dangerous in America, where the only, let us consider this carefully, this might not be so dangerous in a country with a tradition, a greater tradition, an older and more civilized tradition of an authority-ridden royalism than America. But it's doubly dangerous in America because the possibility of any such regime of sharp order, non-constitutional, extra-constitutional, would not be the civilized authoritarianism of a European Gaulism or a Frankism, which undoubtedly those who have been polemicizing with me on this question have in mind, but would be something infinitely worse and different. Something populist in its core, brutal, anti-civilizational, something much, much worse than anything we see wrong in Wallace, an American proto-fascism. This is the only practical and possible authoritarianism, and it is that toward which those who are talking in terms of the breakdown of order and instead of attempting to reconstitute the authority of our constitutional system talk of an authoritarianism. It is that which they, whether they know it or not, would be defending and only could be defending because it is the only possibility of a rank authoritarianism in America with any mass base conceivable. The resources of constitutional government to restore order are immense. There are no limitations of importance in terms of what needs to be done to restore order and to preserve freedom at one and the same time. It is not the guarantees of freedom in our constitutional structure that have created the situation in our streets and in our cities and in our parks and in our universities today. It is the failure of the executive branches and of the people behind the executive branches to move their powers within the constitutional structure to restore order that is creating the situation. There is no necessity or need. The limits within the constitutional structure of the order necessary are all there. It is a matter of will, matter of understanding. It's a matter of will. It is a matter of putting into the seats of power men with a will to do so, with the understanding to do so, a consummation not only infinitely more to be desired than some authoritarian extra-constitutionalism, but much easier incidentally to bring about, because the other question one asks of those who in a panic speak about an order outside of our own traditions of reasoned constitutional government are proposing to do something that if they had the forces to do it, could be done a great deal more easily and a great deal simpler within the constitutional structure. So I regard that reaction to the contradiction facing us as dangerous in itself much more dangerous than its proponents realize, to say nothing of being an absurd proposal in view of the fact that the power necessary to bring it about can be much better, much quicker found within our constitutional structure. The other temptation, and the opposite one, and this danger is created, as I said, in all these cases, partially by the decline of liberalism as a dominant and driving and holding position, and partially by the successive conservatism, strangely enough in this case, by the growth of our strength. And on the other hand, by the fact that while our strength has grown, we have not yet had sufficient strength and clarity to take over the direction of the country. Something I personally attribute to the failure of a conservative majority and of conservative leadership to ensure that coming out of the defeat of 1964, a steady and continuing development of the Goldwater movement was not carried on. It was a sense of shock and of loss that prevented us from turning the Republican Party into a truly conservative instrument and nominating for president a conservative in 1968. But that is the situation in which we are. And therefore, the other temptation, the other side, the other direction from the temptation of authoritarianism today is a danger of the conservative movement losing its own coherence, its identity, its force, and its direction in a blunting of its critical edge where Republican politicians, particularly President Nixon, are concerned. Tory socialism is still socialism. Disraeli is a bad model. The only part of him that's good we're not imitating, that's the imperialist part, the part which made him go forth and defend Britain's honor abroad. Domestically, it's a bad model. And Tory men with Whig measures still bring in the evils of egalitarianism and of statism, even if their intentions are the Tory best. I am not even disagreeing what I'm saying here with much of what Jim Buckley said at lunch today. I am in no sense saying, in my demand that the conservative movement retain its identity, retain its criticism of Republicans and of presidents, even those whom it has supported, I'm in no sense saying that tact, compromise, imagination, innovation are not necessary. Of course they are. This is in no sense a discussion of how you handle this or that individual measure or whether when you are placed in certain positions, you should not go on handing them. What I'm concerned about is the position from which you do it. The maintenance of a basic overall critique and of a basic overall direction and program. And in that respect, certain measures will become intolerable. Others are ones that one can consider or make better than they'd otherwise be, but certain measures and certain approaches above all are intolerable. And I am disturbed as I am by the tendency toward authoritarianism on the one hand, I am disturbed by the tendency toward creeping Nixonism on the other hand. I am not saying that Nixon is never to be supported. I repeat that. I am asking, where is the sharp criticism from an embattled conservative movement of the family assistance plan, of the beginnings of socialized medicine, of massive inflationary budgets, inflationary because practically speaking they are bound to go through the banking system and bound to be monetized, despite Milton Friedman's hopes. The criticism of a degeneration of our defenses, this I think is the most serious of all, relative to the Soviet Union, a crisis in defense that puts our very survival in question and against, and an answer to which our Secretary of Defense speaks of in the last section of his report of changing priorities. All right, it may well be that democratic pressures and liberal pressures demand changing priorities. It is also true that if our defenses are in the situation which they seem to me to be rapidly approaching, I'm not crying doom for 1971 or two, I am crying doom within the decade unless something is done, then it is up to us, whatever a Nixon or a Laird feel they can do, And I give them credit for knowing that there's a crisis and for being disturbed about it. It is up to us to demand of them that they go before the country and say, we cannot afford this kind of expenditure on a series of social programs because the money has to be spent, and it has to be spent in a hurry, and it has to be spent on defense. And if we are to have deficit financing, at least let it be for war. Let it be for the preservation of the existence of our country, for the war powers of the government. Where is the conservative criticism on the socialist aspects of the Nixon program, on the defense question? Where is the criticism, may I put it very simply, that would have met a combination of domestic socialism and too little and too late in defense had these been the national messages, the budget messages of a Kennedy or a Johnson or a Humphrey or a Muskie? As John Ashbrook said to me on one occasion, I must give him credit for the phrase, I cannot view with alarm when President Johnson does it and view with acclaim when President Nixon does the same thing. I'm not saying he's doing the same thing altogether. I want to make it clear this is not a total attack on the administration or on the Republican Party. It is a question, however, where stands that conservative movement within the coalition that elected Nixon that is putting the pressure on and demanding the kind of results that this country needs from a disinterested position, thinking only in terms of the needs of the country and the needs of a reasonable society? Why can we not at one and the same time carry out the support for a position much better than any we would have under the Democrats, and also keep moving, pushing hard on a basic critique of society, moving in the direction necessary, and a critique of programs which only exists because the liberals make the louder noise and because it seems in the absence of a really vocal conservative movement, it seems that the conservatives have, as the politicians would say, nowhere else to go. This is what I see happening to the conservative movement. This is the third of the contradictions I've raised, and it is, in my opinion, the most dangerous one, rising out of a post-liberal America. The failure to retain in this period of transition, in this period of directionless, the kind of critique that we that established our movement and brought it forward. It seems to me that conservatives have to look back a moment, look back at the course they've come in the last 15, 20 years, to see not only what they have indeed accomplished, and let us not be overmodest, we've accomplished a great deal. It is a great achievement. But also to recognize that in some ways we are allowing conservatism to soften. And I don't mean soften in the sense of hard and soft. I mean to cease it, to not maintain its identity, its progress, its movement. It seems to me that sometimes conservatism had a keener edge. It exhibited sharper and deeper political and intellectual resources 7 years ago than it does today. Just because we have more influence today, more access to the seats of power now, that should make it even the more important that we maintain the conservative critique and press the conservative program. This does not negate in practical terms the need of compromise, as I said before, of tact, of political skill, of innovative programs. But it does require of us now more than ever a steady eye on the main course, a balance between principle and practice in which principle is never lost sight of, a continuing awareness that bad measures and bad causes are bad whoever and whatever party puts them forward, a determination to continue to vindicate the conservative outlook, the conservative principles that alone can save this country from disaster.